So thank you, Richard, for seeing us today.
Well, you're welcome.
So today is May 27th, 2015, and we're at the Palmer Museum downstairs in the basement. And I'm Leslie McCartney, and we're here with Richard Estelle and my husband, John Byrne. And I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Micah.
Hi, Micah. So thank you very much for seeing us, and we're here to talk about University of Alaska Fairbanks and your memories or your father's recollections, if you can remember. I understand that you're... Where was your dad from, first of all? Was he from here?
Well, no, he was from Indiana originally. My connection to the university goes back to both my father and my mother. And I don't know if you want the long story or the short story.
Long story, please.
Well, the story begins back in the Gold Rush, 1898, when a young man from Newcastle, Indiana, named Lynn Smith, went to Alaska with the Gold Rush and so on, and beat around to the different strikes in Alaska. And in 1930, he was the marshal, federal marshal in Fairbanks, and he was from Newcastle. And in about Christmas time, he made a trip outside to visit friends and family in Newcastle. And a young man named Howard Estelle lived there, grew up there in Newcastle, and saw in the newspaper that Lynn Smith was visiting town, and he was friends with Smith's relatives. And Howard was always interested in Alaska and the North, and so he beat feet right over there and collared Lynn Smith and was talking with him about Alaska. And Howard had wanted to go to college, but he couldn't afford it. You know, it was Depression time and didn't have any money. But Lynn proposed to him that he come up and attend college at the new agricultural college and school of mines, and that Lynn would give him a job as a jailer in his jail until the creeks opened up in the spring. He'd get a job out on the creeks. So he did. He came back up to Fairbanks with Lynn when he came back up. It was 1930. And so that's how he got there and began attending the college.
What did he study there?
Well, he wound up with two degrees, one in general science and one in agriculture. At the same time that Lynn Smith was going to Alaska to hunt gold, Dr. Georgeson was from the Kansas State University, was establishing a new experiment farm in Sitka. And he recruited one of his agronomy students from back at the university to come up and help him do that. This was 1898. I believe. And so this young agronomy student, Robert William DeArmond, came up one year and then went back and finished his degree and then came back to Sitka in 1903 and went to work full time, then setting up the experiment farm, the experiment station there at Sitka. So he was there for several years. He was kind of a mover and shaker in the community. And by 1907, he was the president of the school board. And the school board hired a new young teacher named Elizabeth Um, Davidson, Elizabeth Davidson. She came there to teach school. And within a couple of years, they were married. And so they had three surviving children there. Their eldest was Robert DeArmond, and then Ruth and Harriet. Well, Ruth DeArmond grew up there in Sitka and went off to college at Oregon State College in Corvallis. She graduated from there with a home economics degree in 1934. And for a couple of years, she took advanced courses back in Michigan. Well, then it comes around to 1935 when the colony formed here in Clamer. And the government, the Extension Service, wanted an extension agent to come here and work with the farmers. So they had hired an agent, but they needed a home demonstration agent to come and work with the women, primarily, women and kids. And Lydia von Hansen, who was the head extension home demonstration agent for the territory, was good friends with Elizabeth DeArmond in Sitka and knew Ruth and knew that she had a degree in home economics and advanced work in dietetics, and so offered Ruth the job, and Ruth accepted. So in 1936, Ruth came here as the home demonstration agent assigned to the valley to work with the colony women and the homesteader women, other women in the community, to help them adapt to this country, teach them how to can moose meat and smoke salmon and, you know, do some of those things that they had never done before, but also how to plan nutritious, balanced meals. Most of these, the colony women were quite young, 20s, 30s. Even the homesteader wives didn't have a lot of training. Most of them didn't have college degrees. And most of them, the only home economic training they had came from mom, you know, what their mother taught them. And oftentimes that wasn't real nutritious. It was, you know. So part of her job was to help form homemakers clubs in various places around the valley. And then each week she would take her pressure cooker or her sewing machine or her tabletop loom or whatever it was that week and travel around to these meetings and do a demonstration, teach them something, how to sew an apron or how to can things and how to prepare meals. And so she'd put on a demonstration, and there would be assignments for the people, the women, to do something and come back and report the following meeting. And then, of course, once that was done, then they'd eat, you know, and gossip. And so that's how a lot of the information got passed around. So that was Ruth's role. She also worked with the 4-H kids a lot. So while she was doing this, 1936 to 1938, then the extension agent who was here left, and the job came open. Well, Howard Estelle applied for the job, and I have a letter from Dr. Bunnell, the president of the college, because the college was the one overseeing the extension service. So that's the college connection here.
Yeah.
So Howard applied for this extension agent job, and Bunnell wrote him a letter. I have a copy of the letter here that you can read if you're interested. Basically, it said, Howard, you're qualified for the job. I want to give you the job, but these are hard times, you know, and these government jobs have to go to family, support families, and you're not married. So, you know, write back and tell me what you want to do about this. I have Bunnell's letter, but I don't have Howard's letter, so I don't know what kind of a deal was struck, but they gave him the job. And so in 1938, he came here to Palmer as the extension agent. Within a very short time, I mean, he came here in 38, Ruth and Howard were married in 1938, so... There was something going on ahead of time. So they got married. But when they got married, then the government said, well, you know, these are hard times, and these government jobs, we can't have two people in one family with government jobs. We've got to spread these around to support families, you know. So when you get married, one of you is going to have to quit. So Ruth quit her job then, and by 1940 they started a family. My oldest brother was born here in 1940. By 1942 they had left the extension service in the valley and moved down to a little farm in Spinard. Spinard in that time was way out in the sticks, you know. And so I was born there in the old Providence Hospital. Then by 1947, moved up to a little farm near Wasilla. 1948, then they bought a colony farm just north of Palmer, and we moved over here. So that's where I grew up. So, the connection with the people and you know, the college, people who ran the college, people associated with the college, people associated with the colony and the experiment farm, the Irwins and all of those people, was really strong in my family because it worked for Oleroyd and Bunnell and all those people. And they knew Lady von Hansen and the others. Anyway. So when I graduated from high school in 1960, it was expected that I was going to go to college. We never really talked about it. I mean, it was just accepted, which I found later to be a very interesting thing, because most people in the valley didn't have college education. There were a few. Both my parents had college degrees, which I never really thought about until later. Was kind of unique. So I got a little scholarship from the local farm co-op to go to Fairbanks to study agriculture. Well, it makes sense. You go to agricultural college to study agriculture. And so I went up there and discovered that the agriculture student body was me. I was the only one enrolled in agriculture at the agricultural college. It really didn't make any difference because, you know, all the stuff you study the first 2-3 years is the same stuff anyway. Well, there I was. Five of us drove up from here to Fairbanks. And that first term for me was really a kind of a disaster. My grade point average was terrible. And it came time after the grades came out, you know, those of us who had poor GPAs had to go and see the Dean of Men. And I knew for sure that, you know, with that kind of a GPA, they were going to boot me out. And so I was really not looking forward to that. At that time, Earl Beislein was the Dean of Men. So there I went, my appointed time, and went into his office. He was sitting behind his desk. He stood up, shook hands, introduced himself, and offered me a chair. I sat down and waited for the axe to fall, you know. And then the first words out of his mouth were, "How's your mother?" He was good friends with my folks, you know, because of the association with the college in the early days and so on. And so at that point, I thought, maybe there's hope, you know, that maybe they're not going to kick me out of here after all. So we had a good chat about the folks and the family and the history. And finally got around to me and my terrible grades. And he suggested that I work a little harder on my grades and let me go. So I didn't get kicked out, and I managed to hang on and continue on. So I went there 3 years then, with the idea of going into forestry, because there was no future in agriculture at that place. So 3 years there, and then I transferred out to Oregon State in the forestry program, and very quickly decided I didn't want to stay in their program there. And so I took some courses in design, in architecture and landscape architecture design, and that really got me excited. But I ran out of money, so the following year I came back and attended UAF another year. At that point, I was planning to get married, and the following fall, the wedding was coming together, and the two of us got a invitation from the state to go teach school out in the village, out in the bush. My fiancée had graduated from Fairbanks that year. I hadn't graduated, but I had a lot of credits, and that seemed to make them happy, partly because they were desperate. It was right down to the last weeks, and they were still hiring teachers for some of the bush schools. So we got married, and 2 days later we were in a pickup going to Fairbanks because we'd been assigned to teach in Tanana. And after an aborted attempt to get out there, we finally made it to Tanana the morning that school was to start. school was going to start at 1 o'clock. We showed up at like 10 and met the other teachers. There was the principal and his wife. There were teachers. There was another couple, and then there was another single man and us. So we showed up, got our assignments. This is what you're going to teach. Okay. My wife had had an education degree, and she had student taught, so she kind of knew what it was all about, and I was faking it. But they were desperate, as I say. So spent that winter teaching school in Tanana, and then transferred back out to Oregon State to finish my degree in horticulture with emphasis on landscape architecture. And to make the rest of that short, I was hired by the U.S. Forest Service as a landscape architect and ultimately made my way back to Petersburg on the Tongass Forest down southeast to get back to Alaska. And then retired from there, came back here, even though I swore I would never live here again because of the wind. But my mother was still living at home, and even though I have a brother and two sisters that live here nearby, and they would check on her every day, there wasn't anybody there at night with her, and she would fall sometimes. One morning my sister came, found mother in the bathtub. She'd been in the bathtub all night. She couldn't get out. So I came back to live in the house with her until finally she decided it was time to go to the Pioneer home across the street. She passed away a couple of years ago in her 102nd year. Wow. So she spent all that time from 1935 till then here in Palmer. She ran a flower shop for many years. Volunteered for lots of things. She helped build the church, the United Protestant Church here in 1936 when they were building that, and so on. Anyway, so then I started working part-time here at the visitor center and museum, and I'm still here. So that's my life story.
In a nutshell.
Yeah.
So do you mind if I skip back and forth?
No, I'm done with my narrative now. It's time for questions.
So did you live on campus when you were at UAF?
I did the first 3 years, the first 2 years. I did. No. The first 3 years, and then when I came back, I lived off campus down the bottom of the hill. Mm-hmm. And it was then that I really really understood what the inversion layer is there in the valley, because I would leave campus and I would walk down the stairs. Are the stairs still there?
Yeah.
I would walk down the stairs, and it was like walking into a bathtub of cold water within 3 steps, you know, you were in the cold. So I lived off campus then.
And boarded somewhere?
I lived in a basement apartment.
So what buildings were there then when you were there in the 1960s?
Well, I lived in Nerland Hall. Uh-huh. The three dorms were there, the women's dorm, Wickersham. Was fairly new when I went there in '60. They hadn't built the food service building or down there by the dorms.
Lola Tilly Commons.
Yeah, I don't know what they call it. Mm-hmm. That was there when I came back, so they must have built that. The year that I was gone. The building program was really starting that year that I came back. That would have been 64, 65, mm-hmm. somewhere there. He built the big one up on the hill. I forget the name of that one. And a big new gymnasium, and you know they were building some new buildings.
Where was the library located then? Was that in Signers Hall at that time, or Bunnell? Remember?
The library was, I think, in Bunnell. Yeah. Right.
And what was Signers Hall used for at that time then?
The Pioneers Hall, the Constitution Hall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was the cafeteria. Up on the top, and there was a barbershop and a bookstore in the basement, and a lounge. There's a lounge at the end there. That was about all I remember that was in there, mm-hmm. Mainly a cafeteria.
Any memorable teachers that you had?
Teachers?
Yeah.
Well, one memory was when I first arrived there, you know, as a freshman. They have orientation, and they have a lineup of all the professors, and you meet them all. And going along, and here's this little short lady introduced herself as Little Tilly, and I knew that name. I may have also recognized her. But she knew me. She knew who I was coming down the line there. I don't know how, but... And then Ivor Scarlin was there. My dad and Ivor were classmates, schoolmates at the same time. The one summer, the two of them were hired to guard and herd the muskoxen. You know the story about the muskox that were brought there and introduced and
so was that during their time then that the muskox came and were introduced?
Well, they
before?
Had come just previous apparently,
mm-hmm.
because there had been a big enclosure built up the Goldstream Valley, and the muskox were in there and apparently some reindeer, and according to Dad, they opened up a fence when some caribou were coming by and captured some caribou in this enclosure, too. They were trying to do some experiments on breeding caribou, reindeer. But they had these muskoxen in there. And these were very valuable critters, you know, and so they hired Ivor and Dad that summer to go out there and live with them. And watch over them. They would count them twice a day, and it was their job if bears or other predators got in that enclosure, they were to do away with them. And so they spent all summer together batching up there, and they would trade off. One would take the first 12 hours, I guess, and the other one, the next 12, was round the clock, watching them moving around through this country and watching for bears, primarily. And they shot a few bears. So Ivor was there, and he knew me, too. I don't know how that happened. Other instructors... let's see, my advisor was Buswell, Dr. Buswell. I forget now just what his job was, but he was the advisor for the agriculture student. there was Dean, who was the... Dean of Wildlife, took class from him. I don't know.
The class sizes must have been quite small then, in all your classes?
Probably so. I mean, I didn't have any comparison, but they were certainly not big auditorium-sized classes like many schools have now.
Mm-hmm.
It was the campus was much more compressed than it is today. We didn't have the dorms up on the hill and the gymnasium clear down at the other end. You know, the gym was in. Yeah, Hess.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Hess Hall. So you had the dorms and most of the classrooms were in Bunnell or over in Ducker. So it didn't take long to scoot around from the buildings, the gym. There were still some of the old wooden buildings. They had just torn down Old Main before I got there. There was a little old wooden building that the ROTC people had, and there was a shooting range kind of right there in the middle. But they were slowly getting rid of the old wooden buildings and building modern ones.
There was no West Ridge. There was no buildings down at the other end of campus at that point. Not when you were there.
No, the dorms and the Geophysical Institute building, I think, were just about all it was.
Mm-hmm.
Was to the west there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said that your dad, when he was the extension agent here, and then he stopped, did he just homestead and farm then afterwards?
He didn't homestead. They bought a little farm down at Spinard.
Mm-hmm.
And they farmed there, they went down in 41. They came back to the old homestead farm. By Wasilla, it would have been 1940, 47, I guess. And we didn't stay there very long. It was an old homestead. It was pretty rough. A little cabin. We didn't have electricity or water. So when they bought the Colony Place, that was a real step up. We had indoor plumbing, we had water, we had a bathtub, a real bathtub, and electricity. Well, we did get electricity out there in Fairview Loop by Wasilla that winter sometime. I remember we all sat around waiting for it to get dark so we could turn on the light bulb. one light bulb there. That was a big deal.
But he tried to make his living farming.
He always wanted to be a farmer. And he grew up on a farms in Indiana, so he had the farm background. Which always surprised me. You know, most kids have a farm background, don't want anything to do with a farm. But he wanted to be a farmer. And so that's why he had the 2 degrees in general science, because he was really interested in science and birds and plants and the natural world. And then he got a degree in agriculture. So he left to try his hand at farming, and until we got to Palmer, an established farm, one of the Colony farms. It was actually a combination of two pieces of two of the Colony farms that were close by, for Bailey's and Anderson's place. So we lived in the Colony house up on Bailey Hill, where the wind blows all the time. And the house didn't have any insulation in it, like the Colony houses weren't well insulated, and so it was cold all winter long. We spent all winter cutting firewood to feed the wood stove in the basement. And the first floor would get kind of warm, but upstairs where our bedroom was, the kids' bedroom, was cold all the time. And it was close to town, and so Palmer was our town. Went to school at the old Central School, and then high school, the new high school. And then off to college.
And how did his hand at farming turn out then? Was he?
Well, he managed to hang on to the land. Mm-hmm. He was a vegetable farmer. We were vegetable farmers for a number of years, and then we got into a grade A dairy mm-hmm. operation. The dairy farming was kind of on the decline. And he finally gave up farming and went to work for the city of Anchorage as the superintendent of their parks and playgrounds in Anchorage. So he had a paycheck and seven kids, you know. A little money coming in was nice. And so he did that until he retired. Mm.
You've mentioned the colonies a few times. Maybe it'd be just interesting for the history of the area of Palmer. I noticed outside the signs that it was one of the New Deal projects, and so maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Yes.
A jumper, John? Yeah. A jumper? Thanks.
It is kind of chilly.
That's okay.
The Matanuska Colony Project. Well, during the Depression, you know, many people in the country were in dire straits. Many small farmers weren't making it, and other people. And so one of the New Deal programs from Roosevelt was to take some of these people who were on relief and move them to another location and use government resources to support them and get them started over in a situation that would give them an opportunity to make a livelihood. There were about 100 of these programs around the country. Not all of them agriculture, some were industrial. But one of the biggest ones was an agriculture resettlement from small farmers in Minnesota and Michigan and Wisconsin who were on relief. They didn't have any money. They had no money to buy seed and fertilizer to grow things. And if they could grow a few things, nobody had any money to buy it from. So it was a real tough deal. There were no jobs to be had. And so the government recruited over 200 of these families to leave there and resettle here. So they put them on trains, brought them all the way across the country to San Francisco, and put them on an old troop transport, the St. Mihail.
And how did they pick this valley? Because they knew that it was a good growing area, or how did it get picked?
There was some indication that agriculture was possible here because there had been some homesteaders in the valley that successfully grew things. Whether they were successful economically was another question because, again, there were very few people here in the territory, so there wasn't a lot of people to sell stuff to. But they learned that they could grow things. Agriculture was possible. The experimental farm established over at Matanuska also established that agriculture was possible. Part of FDR's
New Deal?
His New Deal, but his inclination or assessment of the world situation was that the U.S. had Alaska, but the U.S. population in general didn't have a good relationship. They thought it was all ice and snow, and it was a bad deal, and we really shouldn't be there. And FDR was concerned that both Russia and Japan had their eyes on Alaska because of the resources here. And he figured if it ever came to a fight with them trying to claim this or take over Alaska, he was going to have a difficult time doing that because he didn't have support of the people, because they didn't really care about Alaska anyway. So one of the things he wanted to do was get population here. He figured if you had Americans living in Alaska, and they had relatives down south or people who knew them, then they would rally to support any invasion here. So he wanted to get people here to Alaska. So that was one idea. The other was that he was hearing from the people from the experiment station and other government people, the people from the railroad, and some of the homesteaders and others, that it was possible to have agriculture here in at least in this part of Alaska. So between the two things, there was a real incentive to get some people up there, and here was an opportunity for these people who were in such tough shape to go and maybe make a better life up there. So that's why they selected Alaska and why they selected this particular area, partly because there was farmland here, proven farmland, and partly because the railroad came right through here. In 1916 and 17, the government built a branch line up through the valley to get to Chicoloon coal mines, because they wanted that coal for the Pacific Fleet. So the railroad was here, access was here. There was flat land, there was ag land, there was good soil. So here's a good spot. And so just about this time of the year, 1935, May of 35, all these people showed up. They had been promised a new house and a barn and 40 acres of land and some animals and equipment to start farming. When they got here, their houses hadn't been built yet. The government had surveyed out the different 40-acre tracts of land around, but they had brought up a bunch of workers from San Francisco ahead of time to start getting ready for this influx of people. There were about 1,000 people, 203 families, and a lot of kids, young families, a lot of kids. So when they got here, there were all these tents set up. And so they all moved into these tents set up about where downtown Palmer is today. And I moved into those tents, and then as soon as all the men, colonists, were here, then they drew lots for the tracts of land that would be theirs. And once that was done, and they knew where they were going to be living, then they dragged these tents over and established 10 camps around in the valley so they could be closer to their homestead. So all that summer, construction was going on with their houses and their barns, some land clearing, road building. At the same time, then the government was constructing a community center. They built that big school building and a gymnasium where all kinds of activities could happen in the gymnasium. three churches were built. There was a store where the colonists were expected to do all their trading, because the government was supporting all this. They were on credit, you know. And each month, the family would be given so many dollars to spend at the store. And the people were expected to do their trading. There was a little store across the tracks in the private sector over there. Kozlowski's started the store across there. And there was a bar and a taxi cab and, you know, a few things like that over there. And so the colonists had this community center, and all the kids would come to school, people would come to church, they'd come to the store to buy their stuff. Some of them were spending some of those dollars across the tracks, and that wasn't a good deal. You know, you got to support the colony. So the government said, well, we'll fix that, and so they issued their own money. Bingles, they were called. And the only place then that would take the Bingles was the store, the commissary. And that was supposed to stop people from spending money across the tracks. Well, that didn't last very long, because pretty quick the barkeeper, he'd take Bingles, and the cab guy would take Bingles, because he could come across the tracks and buy stuff over here at the store too. So that didn't last very long, but it was an interesting little thing, and the Bingles are collector's items now, of course. So the colony was quite a close-knit group. The plan, this was all planned in Washington, and the scheme was that you move these people and start this agricultural colony. It wasn't communistic in that these people were allotted the land, but they had to sign a 30-year lease or a 30-year note to buy it. So they were buying their property. But the day-to-day operations for sale of their produce and so on, and how they would operate, was all dictated by the government organization, the Alaska Rural Rehabilitation Corporation, that was set up to run the colony. So while it wasn't communistic, it was very socialistic. And some people comment about that it was such a terrible thing, you know. But I have to remind people that they were in a depression, and there was a lot of question about whether the social system that we had was really working, because people were out of work and they didn't have food, and it wasn't working for them. And so there was a lot of discussion about trying some different systems. There were a lot of people pushing communism and various degrees of socialism and other isms. And so this was really kind of an experiment in a socialistic enterprise to try to bring people together, to work together, to, you know, give them some freedoms but a lot of control and so on. And to some degrees, it worked. Other degrees, it didn't work. People ask me sometimes, well, was the colony a success? And I tell them, it depends on who you're talking about. Some of the people came here, about over half of them left the first year. The government took them back outside.
Because they wanted to leave?
Yeah, there were a few that just kind of came not intending to stay anyway. It was a free lark, right. You know. Others who came and it wasn't what they thought it was going to be. They were still in debt and so on and so on. And the government said, if you don't like it, we'll take you back outside. And they recruited replacement colonists from various other places around the states then to replace them. Some left the colony but stayed in the territory. They get a job up the mines or on the railroad or down at Anchorage, Fort Rich, or start a business of their own, a trucking company or a store or something. You know? And so for the people that left, it was not a success. The people who stayed on the farm, kept farming and managed to make a living, support their children, pay off their debts in 30 years, for them it was a success. The people that found other jobs or made a living here, it was maybe not the success that the government had envisioned, but for them, they were making a living, which they weren't back home. You know? So for them, it was a success, too. Another aspect is that as a result of the colony, when the people moved out onto their tracks, then they had to have roads to get there, you know, to move around. And those initial roads are the bones of the road system in the valley today. They've been straightened and widened and paved and so on. But, you know, that was a success in getting a transportation net started. The people got out there and then they said, gee, it'd be nice to have electricity, you know. So they formed a co-op, the Matanuska Electrical Association, which is still in existence today, producing the lights that we're using right now. So there was another element of success. And then they said, it would be nice to have telephones. And so they formed another co-op, the Matanuska Telephone Association, that provides telephone service in the valley today. They also formed a farmers' co-op. They discovered early on that while they could produce a lot of good stuff, they didn't have much for markets. Again, there weren't a lot of people in the territory. The biggest markets were the military. Fort Richardson down in Anchorage, Fort up at Fairbanks and the railroad, the community of Anchorage, which was starting to grow. But the military was the biggest market, and the military needed lots of stuff to feed all these GIs they had to feed. You know, tons and tons of potatoes and carrots and thousands of dozen eggs and milk and so on and so on. Well, the individual farmers couldn't compete with the big farms outside, and so the government was bringing most of that stuff, at one time, all of that stuff, from the big farms south to feed them. So farmers got together and formed another cooperative, the Matanuska Valley Farmers Cooperating Association, we call the co-op. And so all the members then would pool whatever they produced, their milk. They built a creamery. They bring milk together. They made cottage cheese and ice cream and milk and cream and so on. And brought together all the potatoes and various vegetables. They had facilities here for the farmers to bring them in, to process them, wash them, bunch them, and crate them up. They had some storage facilities for farmers that didn't have enough root cellar space to store the potatoes and things like that. And so by consolidating all of this stuff, then the co-op could bid on the contracts for the military and compete with those guys outside. And it was that way then that the farmers could make some money. Those years when co-op got the potato contract with the military, all the potato farmers made a little money. There were a few years when they didn't, when we ate a lot of potatoes all winter long. We ate anyway. Moose meat and potatoes was kind of what I grew up on. So that experiment, that colony project, basically started the town of Palmer. Was the school, which was very important, and the gymnasium that they played basketball and had dances and movies and weddings, and the first fair was held in that gymnasium in 1936. My mother was the secretary of that first fair. She was still the home demonstration agent. She told a story about over in the gymnasium, on the foyer coming into the gymnasium, there were four little offices around the edge. And she was, as the secretary, she was taking the ticket money to come in and the prize money and all that. She was handling the money. She had it in a little tin box, you know. And somebody came along and said, you know, let's go eat lunch. And so she went with them to eat lunch. And while she was there finishing up lunch, she happened to think that she had not locked her door when she left there. And the cash box was sitting on the desk. And so she hurried back over there, and the door was standing wide open. And the cash box was sitting there on the desk, the top up, it was wide open. And sure enough, all the money was still there. It was a different time.
Right. You know? So a lot of the colony families have are still generations here, still in Palmer?
There are some.
Yeah.
Some folks stayed on the farm, still have the colony farms. Mm-hmm. The kids, the colony kids, you know, are in their 80s now. Grandkids are still there. So there are kids, grandkids, great-grandkids. Some of those families are still around. The colony kids have an organization, and they have an annual get-together. Though some of those who left went out to the States, come back for that. They have the Palmer Historical Society has acquired one of the colony houses and moved it down just down the street from here and refurbished it in with furnishings in the style of the era 1935 to 1945, and they're open as a museum all summer, and most of the docents there are the colony kids, which is kind of cool because they can talk about what it was like to wear clothes like that or you know, live in a house like that. And so people who are interested in that story find that pretty fascinating. Yeah.
I was glad that you raised the cooperative approach, because I figured being in a colony there would have been co-ops that had grown out, because that's the only way they could exist. Did they also found like maybe credit unions or something like that too for banking, or was it mostly just to do with trade and utilities? And
I don't think there was a credit union. The ARRC, the government corporation, I think probably handled any of that kind of thing.
And when did that dissolve, or did it?
Well, it hasn't completely dissolved.
Really?
They pretty much, at some point turned over control of a lot of that stuff to the co-op. The co-op became the central organization for, you know, the economic sale of all the products marketed under the Matanuska-Made label. So the ARC turned a lot of the organizational and the control over to the co-op. The ARC then continued on as a land ownership organization, because they were given a bunch of land, common land that the farmers could use, graze animals on, and so on. So they're still in business as a I don't know all the things they do. Some of it is loan, loans, I think, economic support, and some of it's land ownership management. But it's a far cry from what it was first. Yeah, government programs, you know, never do die.
No, they just morph into something else.
Yeah, and they come down to one person in a desk somewhere.
Well, that's really interesting. Thanks for... Yeah. I didn't really know that history, but...
It's a fascinating story, and it's I think, probably unique in the history of the country, this kind of a program. Like I said, there were a lot of these programs, and I had never heard of them before. But there are other resettlement communities around the country with their own history, some agriculture oriented, some industrial oriented.
But it would have been a really tight-knit community. I mean, everybody would have left family. I mean, this would have become your family, you know.
That's exactly right. You listen to people talking about leaving there. It was very much like the people who left Europe to come to America.
Right.
They fully expected that they would never see them again. They were leaving to go to Alaska.
Right.
And every much in their minds, at least, off the other side of the world. And, of course, all these people were thrown together on the train as the different groups from the various states got on the train. Then they became a group. They got on the boat. They were sharing all that experience. All the kids were together, you know, and the parents got to know each other. And then when they got here, they were all in it together. And you know what happens when you get a group together, have it sharing an experience? It's a connection, and these people, you know, are really connected. They've lived their lives together, you know, for a long time.
That's the importance of a school and the community, sense of community, sense of building everything together.
Yeah.
Business survival.
Well, they got here. They built the churches. The government didn't build the churches. Initially, the plan was there was going to be one church. Everybody was going to share that church. Well, you can imagine how well that went over. So they protested, people protested, and the government set aside three lots over across the street from the school. And there were three churches built, a Catholic church, Catholics built their church, the Lutherans, a lot of Lutherans, you know, these were Norskis, these were Scandinavian people, a lot of Lutherans. They built their church, and the Presbyterians, Protestant Presbyterians, built their church, and it's the only one that's still there. All three have churches there, but the other two have been moved and rebuilt. But the old log church that the Protestant people that my mother helped build is still there. So, yeah, you're right. Very close in it. Not only the church and the school, but there were a number of organizations. You know, I mentioned the homemakers clubs. So there was some close-knits there. The 4-H clubs, the Scouts, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts. And there were always activities going on. 4th of July parades and the fair. And the first fair was 1936. They survived that one year, and they decided to celebrate and show off what they were producing. So there were a lot of events that people...
Well, even the geography, I mean, we're in the middle of a valley. You're surrounded by mountains here. So even that's sort of like a way to make people come together.
Yeah, you just couldn't hardly get out of here.
Yeah, the local geography itself makes you...
The railroad, initially, the railroad was the only way in and out. Fairly soon, they made the connection. They built a bridge across the Matanuska and the Connect River. Mm-hmm. So there was a road to get to Anchorage, but it was a little narrow, rough gravel road. You know, if you could average 35 miles an hour, you were daring. And so it was an adventure going there. You didn't do it very often. So you're right, it's pretty isolated. They had to make their own fun. The folks would get together to go fishing. The colony had some gill nets. And you could check out the gill nets. And they'd go out a little rutty road out to Goose Bay and set the set net out from the beach and catch salmon. I remember going out doing that once, and there's several families went together, and we had... I don't think we had a skiff. We had to wait for low tide. Low tide, you'd string that net out from the beach, and there was an oil drum float out there. Tide would come in, fish would get in the net, tide would go out, you'd slog out through the mud, pick the net, drag the fish out. The little kids have to drag the fish up to the beach. And the women then would clean the fish. And we'd also go out to a creek, Fish Creek. And in those days, you could snag salmon. And so the guys would get some of these big treble hooks, you know, and put sinker weights on them and get a pole and some chalk line, and you go out there and throw that into the water and jerk it across and grab a salmon and yard it up on the bank, and the kids then we'd jump on that salmon and club it into submission and drag it down to where the women had set up a butcher board. They'd process them while the men were yarding in more fish. And then, of course, the women, they'd come back, and women would get together and they'd can the fish. And, you know, that was 2 or 3 days of mm-hmm. processing and eating. Mm-hmm. And a great, great effort.